Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
All right, welcome back to our midweek studies. Did everybody enjoy your time off? Did you do constructive things with your time off? I'm doubting it. Yes.
They're making up on the constructive stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Making up for lost time. We, on Wednesday nights, don't have a worship service per se. We just treat it like Bible study time. So I hope everybody brought a Bible. If you need one, there's some in the back. It is our intention tonight to begin our survey of the book of Leviticus. We have taught verse by verse through Genesis. We taught verse by verse through Exodus. Tonight we're starting in Leviticus, so you can turn to the book of Hebrews. Hebrews 10 is the first place we're actually going to look at the Bible, but we're going to do kind of an introduction to the book of Leviticus tonight, and then we'll probably read a chunk of the first chapter. So that's my broad spectrum intention for what we'll get done tonight. But before we jump right into our study of the book of Leviticus, it's been a few weeks, so I haven't had an opportunity to rant and rave about anything, as I am so fond of doing on Wednesday nights. And so I thought perhaps a little commentary before we begin this evening, because I can, because I'm the one with the microphone. Therefore, I get to do what I want. Megan and I were watching a National Geographic special last night. It was one of those, the lost books of the Bible. Ooh, yeah. Where the bias is very heavy. The impression that they want to give is that the early church, in a very rub your hands together, snidely whiplash sort of way, knew about all these other books that were available to be included in the Bible. But then a bunch of men cloistered together in a room somewhere and said, we can't have those books in our Bible, so we're just going to pick these books, and that will continue to maintain our power. Of course, the other books they're talking about are the Gnostic books that carry the names of apostles that were written some 300 to 400 years after Jesus walked on the planet. Anybody in the room here ever heard of, like, the Gospel of Thomas?
Sure.
You familiar with that? Sure. Have you heard of the Gospel of Philip? Or the Gospel of Mary? Or the Apocalypse of Peter? Well, these are all what are known as Gnostic books or Gnostic Gospels that were written well after the fact. The reason that they weren't included in the canon of the New Testament is that, number one, the canon had already been essentially solidified by the time those books were written. And secondly, they didn't have the same eyewitness validity that the books of the New Testament have. And thirdly, the theology was quite different. For instance, they don't tell you this in these specials, but when they talked about, oh, the Gospel of Thomas, how it should have been included. Anybody here see the movie or read the book on the Da Vinci Code that was out a couple years ago? You familiar with that? They spend a lot of time talking about the Gospel of Thomas. Did you know that in the Gospel of Thomas, it says, you women in the front row will be interested in this, says that women can't go to heaven. And so women who are saved become men.
Oh, we get promoted. Oh,
you get promoted, exactly. You get promoted up to malehood when you get to heaven. Now, they don't tell you that kind of stuff because that would make you say, well, that's loony. But in order to keep you interested in the notion, this fabrication of theirs, this idea that there were other books of the Bible that the church hid from you so that you couldn't have that secret higher knowledge, in order to keep that from you, they just don't tell you that other stuff. There are stories of Christ as a young man learning that he has powers, rather like Superman when he's still living on the Kent farm. And he's learning that he has these abilities And he's a really bratty kid. And he does things like strike a child so that the kid dies because the kid bumped him in the marketplace. Now, can you see why the early church, wanting to preserve the genuine gospel, would look at documents written 300 years later and say, these are heretical. We're not including them in the canon because they have no validity. So where do these books come from? Why do these books exist? Did anyone go and see the movie The Passion of the Christ when it was out a few years ago? Okay. You're a good example, Jeff and Laurel, because you're biblically familiar. And so when you were watching The Passion of the Christ, was there anything in the movie that jumped out at you as unbiblical or extra-biblical? Sure, exactly. She was miming the snake in the garden and the temptations. There's a lot of stuff in there that is not biblical. That movie was based on the visions of a Catholic mystic, but it wasn't based on the Gospels. So why did that movie become such a big hit? It became a really big hit because it was a compelling story that had a familiar character, Jesus, at the center of it. In other words, human beings like to tell stories. We've always been storytellers. Human beings have always conveyed stories to one another. And if you want to write a really compelling story that'll gain an audience, put a famous character in the middle of your story. Has anybody here seen the Shakespeare play or read the Shakespeare play Henry V? Okay. Henry V was a real king. He really lived. And then Shakespeare wrote a play about him. But Henry V did not speak in poetic verse. You understand what I'm saying? So Shakespeare took a real historic character, wrote a story about him, but what he said about him is largely fictionalized, even though it's based on a real person in some real events. Human beings have always done this with famous characters. And so it's not at all beyond our imagination to imagine storytellers wanting to tell compelling stories and putting this Jesus character in the middle of it. Humans have always done that. But if you come in here and tell me that you've constructed a story about Jesus during his lost years, somewhere between 12 and 30, and your story is that he was a shipbuilder and he was really good at shipbuilding, you might make up a really compelling story, but I'm not going to trust my soul to it because it has no validity because you are not a firsthand witness to those events. The Bible claims to be firsthand witness accounts that are written within 30 years of the actual events. Very early. And the early Pauline letters, the earliest of Paul's letters, include early Christian creeds that developed within years of Jesus being on the planet. Now that has much more credibility than somebody who constructed a story about Jesus 300 years after the fact. The example I like to use is the United States has been a country, a nation, under a constitution, a free and separate sovereign nation for just over 200 years. And we were established as a nation on the basis of a constitution, a written document. Now, how many ways has that document been interpreted in the last 200 years? Does anybody think they can actually find the language of the right to an abortion in the Constitution? Because it's not in there. But you'll hear people argue that abortion is a constitutional right because they have interpreted it in ways far different than the actual language. Okay, so now think about the Gnostic writings. They are 300 to 400 years separated from the fact. How much time does that give them to develop interpretations and stories that are far different from the original? So we're watching National Geographic last night, and they're talking about the lost books of the Bible, the books that didn't get in, the Gnostic books. And then they kept referring to these early writers as early Christian scholars. The Gnostics were not early Christian scholars. History tells us who the Gnostics are. Gnosticism believes that everything fleshly is bad. Everything spiritual is good. Therefore, for Jesus to be Son of God, he could not have been actual flesh and blood. Therefore, they propound that he was simply an image, a spirit, but he was not real human flesh and blood. And that's why John the Apostle, writing against these kind of Gnostic ideas, starts his gospel right out with the Word became flesh. That was a very important idea. So very early on, the Bible started countering the Gnostic heresies that were already surrounding the Jesus story. Now, I watched 2 hours of this program last night. And not once did they tell the audience any of what I just told you. And yet they had scholars on, Christian scholars. They had a woman from Harvard who was teaching at their divinity school. And they had different people who would come on and say, well, now the Gnostics, and try to explain to us why there was some validity to these things. Do you know why there's no validity to the Gnostics? Number one, they start with the wrong philosophical standpoint. They deny the death, burial, and resurrection. Now, fundamental to genuine Christianity is the idea that the resurrection is the proof positive that God accepted the sacrifice of Christ, and therefore we are redeemed and forgiven before God. Paul goes so far as to say, if there is no resurrection, then we are still in our sins, and we are of all men most miserable. The heart and soul of Gnostic theology is the death never happened. It was never genuine. It wasn't real. It was imaginary. So Gnosticism and Christianity are not one and the same thing, despite the fact that the special last night kept calling them early Christians. They were early anti-Christians telling a completely different story. So this happens every year. You know, Christmas came around, the holidays came around, and there was a glut of new anti-Christian, disguised as intellectual, disguised as the search for the truth type TV programs. And they'll settle down now again for a little bit, but in the spring, right around Easter, watch for them. They'll be back. They're going to recycle these same things again. They're going to come around and they're going to go after the real resurrection. Under the guise, under the false pretense that they're being honest and intellectual and trying to inform you, be very aware that they're only telling you a very small part of the story. I think we as intelligent Christians need to know the whole story. So that's why I thought I'd start out tonight by saying, don't be fooled by those programs. There is very good historic reason why the Gnostic books were not included in the Bible. It's because they're not valid. They're just Jesus stories. And to this day, Hollywood is still churning out Jesus stories. But don't hang your soul on Hollywood or the Gnostics. Does that make sense?
Yep.
All right, so now let's talk about the book of Leviticus, because that's what we're here for. The book of Leviticus is the third of the five books that are attributed to Moses, called the Pentateuch. You can hear the penta, the five, right in there. The first five books of the Bible. The book of Leviticus, unlike Genesis and Exodus, which are largely narrative, telling a story, the book of Leviticus jumps right into, here are the rules. And actually, the book did not have a title. Moses did not say, and now I shall construct the book of Leviticus. That didn't happen. The original name for it in the Hebrew meant, and he called. So the original title for the book was, And He Called. So if you think about Genesis as the beginning, and if you think about Exodus, of course, it's the story of the Exodus from Egypt, then once God had taken his people out of Egypt and brought them to Mount Sinai and gave them the tablets of stone and gave them the construction of the temple, the next thing he did was then he called. And what he called Israel to was holiness. He called them to be a separate people. Now, when this book was translated into the Greek in the Septuagint version, it was given the Greek name Leoitikos, which meant having to do with the Levites, because most of the early rules have to do with the Levites. So it was given that name. And then when the Latin Vulgate was translated, it Latinized that word to Leviticus, which just moved into the English language. So it means having to do with the Levites. But even that is a bit of a misnomer because it's not really about all the Levites. It's about the priests that served in the temple. And starting at like chapter 9, chapter 10, we finally get into a little bit of narrative. Before that, it's all rules, 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 rules about sacrifice. So God starts with sacrifice rules, and then we're going to hear about how to do it wrong, Nadab and Abihu, or Nadab and Abihu, depending on your pronunciation. And then God gets into just particulars, little particular laws. Now, here's what we have to remember as we read through the book of Leviticus. Every single one of these rules was absolutely incumbent on every Israelite. They did not have options. God did not say, here's some suggestions. If you want to make me happy, here are some things you can do. God laid absolute requirements on these people. Over 600 individual laws make up the law of Moses. That's why we're starting in the book of Hebrews, so we can start with the Christian New Covenant mindset as we read the book of Leviticus. We have this huge advantage. We have an advantage that the early Israelites did not have in that we have the New Testament, and the New Testament helps open up the Old Testament so that we can understand what God's grand design and plan was. So in our introduction to the book of Leviticus, I want to talk a little bit about why. Why these laws? Why these rules? Why did God spend so much time constructing all these rules and laws in so much detail? And I think the key to it all, I know I told you to go to Hebrews, but in Leviticus 19, this is really sort of the purpose statement for the whole rest of the book. After God has laid out rules and rules and laws and standards and do this, chapter 19 starts, "Then the Lord said to Moses, speak to all the congregation of the sons of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy." And that's really the root. That's really the key to the whole book, is God is holy, therefore he called his people to be holy like him. However, he also knew they couldn't do it. And yet he imposed all these rules on them. So that leads to a lot of theological questions like, well then, why? Why for 1,400 years did you take this people group, several million people, and impose this law on these people? Why did you do this to them, God? Well, now we can look at Hebrews 10. Hebrews 10, well, let's just start right at the very beginning of it. Everything that we're going to read tonight constitute what's called the law. When we were looking at the book of Exodus, I drove home this point, but at the risk of being redundant, I'm going to make this point over and over again. The law of Moses is a unified whole. And if you are guilty of any one part of the law of Moses, you are guilty of the whole law of Moses. The law of Moses has attached to it certain blessings for Israel. If you do these things, I'll bless you. I'll protect you from your enemies. I'll take you into a land of milk and honey. You'll always have plenty to eat. Your crops won't fail. You'll have plenty of children. Out of all the people on the planet, you will be my unique people, a kingdom of priests to God. All of these great promises. But God didn't stop there. He then said, and if you don't do it, I'll bring your enemies down on you. I will scatter you out of your land. I'll drive you into the land of your enemies. I will cut you off from your people. Curses! And so the law is conditional. The law is a covenant God made with Israel that was a conditional covenant. If you do this, I'll bless you. If you don't do it, I'll curse you. It is not a mistake that the very last word of the Old Testament is curse. Because that's how it ends. And then, of course, you get into the New Testament and you start reading Matthew and you start hearing about what God's going to do about the curse. And what he's going to do is what the writer of Hebrews is talking about. And what we also have to understand is that the law of Moses was a covenant made with a particular people. It was a covenant made with Israelites. And none of the Israelites performed the law perfectly. Therefore, all of Israel fell under the hand of God's curse. And that's where we find them when Jesus walks on the planet. So the book of Hebrews is written by a Hebrew to Hebrews. Stop me when this is too obvious. So he's writing to an audience that is under the law. He's writing to the very people who have had to devote themselves to slavish devotion to every rule of the law. And these people have been slaughtering animals. The book of Leviticus is going to begin with sacrifices. God starts right in with, okay, I'm going to call my people and tell them to start killing animals. Burnt offerings, moves from there into food offerings called meat offerings, from there into peace offerings, from there into sin offerings and into trespass offerings, and it all has to do with sacrifice, kill, blood. And that teaches us something very, very important. And Paul writes about it in the book of Romans, that the wages of sin is death. When someone sins, someone dies. That's God's economy. Like it or not, I don't care what that does to your conception of God, God is so serious about holiness that when he calls his people and says, I'm holy, therefore you be holy, that when they sin, something dies. And so God is going to introduce, right at the beginning of the book of Leviticus, he's going to introduce the idea of substitution. And he's going to allow that sinful people can put their hands on the head of an animal, and the animal's going to die in their place. For 1,400 years, from Leviticus forward, the Israelites were constantly bringing animals and killing them in the tent of meeting. That's a grand name for a place that really was the tent of constant flowing bloodshed and death. The tent of meeting, the place where you would go and meet with God and then have to sacrifice constantly. The amount of animals and skin and bloodshed and flowing blood that came out of the tent of meeting is unfathomable to us. It's just remarkable, remarkable stuff. So why? Why did God do this? Well, it turns out that he was teaching. Jesus, when he walked on the planet, we like to talk about, oh, well, he healed, or oh, he did miracles. But what he did most of the time is he taught. Paul went church to church teaching. The Christian ministry ought to be a teaching ministry. God was teaching his people some very important lessons. One was, for sin comes death. When you sin, something has to die. That's how serious God is about sin. And by the way, God has not lightened up on that concept. Sin is still real serious in God's eyes. Christianity did not make God go, ah, forget it. You're doing fine, you tried. Come here, you little goof. Silly people. He was so serious and is so serious about sin, he killed his son over it in your place. Because you sinned, someone has to die. And so he taught the concept of a substitute, that a substitute could die on behalf of another and God would take out the sin and the curse and the wrath on someone else. And he teaches that right away early in Leviticus when he starts with these multiple different kinds of offerings, burnt offerings, peace offerings, sin offerings, trespass offerings. They all speak to the same thing, which is something has to die in your place. And rather than it be you, out of mercy, out of God's grace, he established a method even under the law for something else to die for you. All of which, according to the writer of Hebrews, pointed to Christ. 1,400 years, Israel did this so that when Christ walked on the planet, they would recognize what he was there for. And then John writes He came to his own, and his own received him not. Boy, are human beings sinful. Even though they had 1,400 years of God saying, now watch for him, he's coming. I'll even tell you what city he's going to be born in, and I'll even tell you when. I'll even have magi come from the east following a star that says to your king, there he is, the king is born, and Israel will still say, nope, got no idea. That's how sinful people are. That's how depraved humans are. So Hebrews 10 starts, for the law. Oh, that was the point I was going to make 10 minutes ago. Good, I talked all the way around it. We will get to a text tonight. I promise you we will. For the law, when the writer of Hebrews, a Hebrew writing to Hebrews, when he says the law, they all know what he's talking about. He's talking about the totality of the Mosaic law. There are concepts, philosophies in different churches that say that the law of Moses can be divided into separate categories. That part of it is a civil law. Don't kill, take care of your neighbor. If your neighbor's sheep falls in a ditch, pull it out. Civil laws. And then they'll say other parts of it are the moral law, which they'll say are like the Ten Commandments, overarching big moral laws. And then they'll say other parts of it are the ceremonial law. And the ceremonial law is all the stuff about sacrifices and killing animals and the tent of meeting and all that kind of stuff. So they try to divide the law into those three categories so that they can say that when Jesus died, he died for the ceremonial aspects of the law, but the other two aspects are still binding on the Christian conscience. I say, no fair. You can't do that to the law, and the reason you can't do it is that no Old or New Testament writer does that to the law. Instead, they always refer to the law as a collective. The law. It's the law. And as we were reading through Exodus, I challenged you all as we went through different laws. I challenged you and I said, okay, which category is that? And it got really difficult to say, well, you know, oh, that has to be this category. Because sometimes they overlapped categories. Sometimes you'd have two things, two laws juxtaposed against each other, where one was, now remember my Sabbath and no other gods, and in the same sentence he'd say, and don't boil a kid in his mother's milk. And you go, well, how do you put those two together? And they're all the law is the point. The more you look into the details of the law, the more you have to conclude that the law is one great big unit. So chapter 10 of Hebrews says, for the law, since it has only a shadow of the good things, it only has a shadow of the good things to come, but it doesn't have the very form or substance of things. So therefore, it could never, by the same sacrifices year after year, which they offer continually, it could never make perfect those who draw near to God by the law. So every year, Israel had to sacrifice animals. Every time, according to Leviticus, we're going to see this one, every time you sin, even if you're unconscious of the sin, once you become aware of the sin, you have to go sacrifice because you're aware that you're a sinner. And then once a year, the high priest has to go into the holiest place with a particular sacrifice, wearing particular clothes, with a particular blood and a particular incense, and he goes in and makes atonement for the whole nation of Israel. So there's this constancy to them year by year, week by week, month by month, even day by day, having to do these sacrifices. And the writer of Hebrews says, but all those sacrifices never actually perfected anybody. God said, you can do it. In a substitutionary way, you can kill animals so that I don't kill you, but that's never going to perfect you. And if you're going to stand before God, you have to be perfect. So we have a great big problem. Jesus walked around saying stuff like that. Except your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will in no wise see the kingdom of God. And the scribes and the Pharisees are the ones that are trying to keep the law. And Jesus says, unless you're doing better than them, you have no hope, which is his way of saying you're no good and neither are they. Nobody's doing it. So he says the fact that they did it year by year, proves that it wasn't working. Otherwise, they would have quit doing it. They would have said, well, there we go. We've Taking care of that. That's what verse 2 says. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered? Because the worshipers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have had a conscience of sin? Once you were perfectly cleansed from your sin, you'd be good to go. So all these animals they were sacrificing year after year never cleaned anybody, never perfected anybody, never made it okay between them and God. So then what's the purpose? That was my original question. Why all these animals? That's what verse 3 is going to tell us. But in those sacrifices, there is a reminder of sin year by year. In other words, the sacrifices of the law were for the purpose of saying to Israel over and over and over and over again, you're sinful. Because you had to keep remembering to bring animals. You had to keep remembering to bring sacrifice. You had to keep remembering to kill things. You had to keep remembering to go to a priest. You had to keep remembering to do that to keep your relationship with God going. And so even Paul says that the purpose of the law was to expose sin for how sinful it is. And believe me, if you got to do that every day, constantly, even if you trip up in a little way you didn't know you tripped up, and then somebody comes to you and says, you know, you missed law number 437 over here. You didn't get that one. And you go, oh, all right, where are the animals? Hey, you got to go get an animal, take it to the priest, and kill it, because it is a constant reminder of how sinful we are. That was the purpose of the law. Verse 4, for it is impossible for the blood of bulls and the blood of goats to take away sin. Why? Because they're just created beings. They're just creatures. They're part of this fallen reality that we live in. So even though they could die substitutionarily in our place, they couldn't really cleanse us. They didn't make us perfect. They didn't make us able to stand before God. Wherefore, verse 5, wherefore, when Christ comes into the world, he says, sacrifice and offering you have not desired, but a body you have prepared for me. In other words, Christ came, and the writer of Hebrews argues that Christ is our high priest. And what a high priest does is go in and sacrifice. But when Christ came to the planet, God did not require from him that he make sacrifice and oblation from animals. Instead, God prepared a body for Christ so that he himself would be the ultimate sacrifice. A body you have prepared for me in whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin, you've taken no pleasure. Now, as soon as we start the book of Leviticus, the first thing we're going to see is burnt offering and then offerings for sin. And here Jesus says, God never took pleasure in that. Instead, then I said, verse 7, behold, I have come. In the scroll of the book it is written about me. There's your clue. Why the law? Why all this stuff that Israel had to do? Why all these rules? Because it's all about Christ. It's all pointing to Christ. Paul says in the book of Galatians that the law was a pedagogos. There's a good Greek word. We get our English word pedagogue from that. It means a teacher. But in Greek parlance, it meant the household servant who was responsible for taking the kids by the hand to their daily studies. And so Paul says, that's what the law was. The law was meant to take children, sinful people, people not grown up in the things of God, and take them by the hand and lead them to their studies. And Paul says that it leads us to Christ, that the purpose of the law is to show us where the real perfection is. After saying the above, says verse 8, sacrifice and offerings and whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you have not desired, nor hast thou taken any pleasure in them, which are offered according to the law. Then he said, behold, I have come to do your will. So he takes away the first in order to establish the second. I don't know if you know it. I don't know if you just felt it when I read it. But that was the best news you ever heard. Because the reason we today, Gentile church 2,000 years after Christ being on the planet, the reason we're not killing animals The reason we're not trying to keep the 600 some odd laws is because Christ came and established the new covenant. And in the new covenant, instead of saying you have to sacrifice animals for forgiveness, John instead writes, when we sin, we confess our sin, and he is faithful and just to forgive us our sin. Really? That's all there is to it? Really, I just confess it? That's all I've got to do? All I got to do is go and admit I'm a sinner to God? That's all I've got to do? That sounds easy, doesn't it? It's remarkably difficult for human beings to do. Ask people, are you a sinner? People don't like that question. They'll go, well, I'm not that bad. You know. And then they'll start qualifying. I'm not Hitler. You know, I'm not Madonna. You know, I'm not. You know. They'll qualify. They'll say, well, I'm not that bad. Except that the standard is not other human beings. You can't compare yourself horizontally to other humans and impress God. Because the standard is not Hitler or Mother Teresa. The standard is God's righteous holiness. Therefore, the distance between the best person who ever lived and the worst person who ever lived is infinitesimal compared to the distance between the best person who ever lived and God's righteousness. Infinitely higher than the best person is God. And the distance between the best and worst gets really, really small by comparison. All human beings, according to Paul writing to the Romans, all human beings are not just sinful, but there is none that does good, no, not one. Which is no surprise, because even Isaiah said that our best righteousness is filthy rags. Man in his best state is altogether vanity. There's nothing in the Bible that ever says, boy, you humans are doing great. Keep up the good work. It says you're just desperately no good, and God is infinitely holy and good. So what are you going to do about that gap? What are you going to do about that problem? And what God did to solve that problem was send his Son in the likeness of human flesh to be our substitute, to absorb God's wrath and punishment and the curse for us. Therefore, we no longer have to bring animals. We plead the blood that has already flowed at Calvary. And we say, that sacrifice, that once-for-all sacrifice, that was good enough. That was enough for me. I'm covered by that. Here, we'll let the writer of Hebrews say what I just said. And he'll say it much better than I said it. Behold, I've come. This is verse 9. Behold, I have come to do your will. So he takes away the first, which is the law, in order to establish the second, which is the sacrifice of Christ by the will of God. By this will, the will of God, we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. Unlike the sacrifices that had to be done every day, every year, every month, all the time, Jesus only did it once for all. One sacrifice, and by that one sacrifice, we are sanctified. Now, that's really important, because what that means is, by his sacrifice, we are hagios. It's the same Greek word that's translated holy other places in the Bible. What God said in the book of Leviticus when he called Israel is he said, be holy like me, because I'm holy, and nobody could do it. And so Christ died, buried and resurrected, took our sin debt, and then sanctified us so that we are able to stand before God holy, accomplishing what God wanted in the first place that no human could do on their own, so that Christ would get all the glory in bringing many sons to glory. Do you see the big picture? Oh, it's a wonderful big picture. But the writer of Hebrews isn't quite done, so let me just finish this passage, because it's just such a great passage. By the will of God, by this will, verse 10, we have been sanctified, set apart, hagios, made holy, through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. Every priest stands daily ministering and offering time after time the same sacrifices which can never take away sin. But Christ, having offered one sacrifice for sin for all time, sat down at the right hand of God. I like to point out that in the furniture in the tabernacle in the wilderness, when we finished our study of the book of Exodus, we wrapped up the book of Exodus with talking about all the furniture that was constructed for the tabernacle. The one piece of furniture that was obviously missing out of all the pieces of furniture in the tabernacle was a chair or a sofa or a stool or any place to sit down. Because when the priests were in the tabernacle working, the work never stopped. The work just kept going and going and going, and the blood kept flowing and flowing because Israel kept sinning and sinning. And so the sin and the death and the blood and the flow and the work all went together constantly, but Christ, after one sacrifice, sat down. The work was done. It's finished once for all. And he didn't just sit down. He sat down at the right hand of God, where he ever lives, the same writer is going to say, to make intercession for us. So now, instead of us being aware that we've sinned and having to go kill an animal and run back and find a priest and do all that, now when we sin, we have an intercessor in heaven pleading our cause and saying to the Father, I've already paid for that. I've already taken care of that. Every priest stands daily ministering, verse 11, offering time after time the same sacrifice which can never take away sins. But he, Christ, having offered one sacrifice for sin for all time, sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time onward until his enemies are made a footstool for his feet. Now look at this. He just got done telling us that the blood of bulls and the blood of goats could never perfect anybody. Verse 14, for by one offering, Christ has perfected for all time those who are sanctified, set apart by his one offering. Do you see that? That's good news. That is great, great news. That's the difference. People ask, people who are not adept at Bible study, who don't know how to read their Bible or understand the covenants and the contrasts in the Bible, they read something like Leviticus and they say, there's all these rules and laws and animals and killing. They say, are we supposed to do that? Is some part of this still incumbent on us? Is some part of the law still supposed to be in my conscience? Is some part of what Moses said to Israel still supposed to be weighing on me today? Well, the writer of Hebrews, a Hebrew writing to Hebrews, the very people who were under that first covenant and under the law, he very clearly just said, the answer is no. None of the law is to weigh on your conscience. You now have the freedom to go to God individually without having to have a priest because you already have a great high priest interceding for you at the right hand of God. You no longer need to kill animals because that one sacrifice did it. And you no longer have to have any kind of intercessor between you and God. Israel could not go to the holiest place. Israel couldn't enter the tent of meeting. Only the priests could do that. But when Jesus died, the curtain in the temple that separated the holiest place was torn open from top to bottom. And people argue about why. Why? Was it to let God out? And I say, no, it's to let us in. It was so that we now can enter the holiest place. We have access to heaven. We have access to the throne room of God where we can come boldly, says Paul, to the throne of grace, crying, Abba, Father. No Israelite could do that. All he knew was sin, death, blood, sin, death, blood. But then Christ came and made the full atonement and perfected his people. Therefore, we rest fully and completely in his finished work. And that's far, far different, higher, and better. You got that? Okay, now turn to Romans 3. We're heading toward Leviticus. Romans 3. We're going to start in verse 21. But now, apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been manifested. being witnessed by the law and the prophets. In other words, the law and the prophets, which means the bulk of the Old Testament, witnessed to or taught that, drove us to this conclusion that righteousness, the righteousness of God, can be established apart from the law. And look at how he says it. This is just a wonderful bit of theological detail Paul adds here. Even the righteousness of God, verse 22, through faith in Jesus Christ, for all those who believe, for there is no distinction, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, being justified freely or as a gift by his grace, through the redemption which is in Jesus Christ. Now look at verse 25. Jesus Christ, whom God displayed publicly as a propitiation in his blood through faith, this was to demonstrate his righteousness, because in the forbearance of God, he passed over the sins previously committed. What does that mean? It means that all these animal sacrifices didn't take away the sin, didn't perfect anybody, like the writer of Hebrews says, but it was the method through which God was long-suffering toward Israel's sin till Christ got here. So the purpose of the animal sacrifice was always pointing toward the final sacrifice, and it allowed God's long-suffering to forbear with the sins that were past. So that when Christ came and died, he didn't just die for the future sins of his people, he died for the collective sin of Israel up until that point in all the animal sacrifice they'd been going through. So there was a lot going on that cross. There was an awful lot happening at Calvary as God was pouring out his wrath on Christ to fulfill everything that the law had for 1400 years been pointing at. Got all that? Okay, that was all introduction. So it technically doesn't count against my time. But it's 5 minutes to 8. So I'm going to have to fly through the first chapter of Leviticus just so I can say that we did actually reach the book of Leviticus tonight. So turn back to Leviticus. Here's the way the first couple chapters are laid out. Like I said, first he's going to talk about burnt offering. Then he's going to talk about food offering, meat offering. Then he's going to talk about peace offering. Then he's going to talk about sin offering and then trespass offering. A lot of the details are going to be similar. First, he goes through each of those kinds of offering and tells us what constitutes that offering. If you're going to bring a peace offering, what do you have to bring to constitute a peace offering? Then once he has established those five big offerings, he then reviews them again and tells how to do it. So first he starts with what it's made of, then he goes back through the five again and says, and then here's how you do it. So let's see if we can at least get chapter 1 out of the way. Chapter 1 is going to tell us the law of the burnt offering. Everybody there? All right. Then the Lord called to Moses and said to him from the tent of meeting, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when any man of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of the animals of the herd or of the flock. If his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall offer it a male without defect, and he shall offer it at the doorway of the tent of meeting, that he may be accepted before the Lord. Burnt offerings are a fascinating thing throughout the Old Testament, because Paul even picks up the language of burnt offering in the New Testament. Burnt offering was a sacrifice to God where you essentially destroyed the best of what you had. He said, when a man brings a burnt offering, he has to bring the best of his flock, without spot, without blemish. He can't have any sickness in him. Well, in an agricultural society where wealth is based on the size of your flocks, a really healthy animal is great for breeding. That makes more healthy animals. So God says, bring your cleanest, healthiest, spotless animals and burn them. Does that make any sense at all? It's a way of recognizing that God is your source of supply in everything, and you don't bring a gift to God that is worthless. Should I apply that? So here's what you'll do with it.
My rendition says it has to be of your own free will. Free will offering.
Right. Free will offerings and sacrifices are two different things. If it's harvest time and you bring in your first fruit has to go to God. That's a requirement. Tenths, tithes of everything, and there are multiple tithes that if you add it all up, comes up into 27, 28% of your gross for the good of the Levites, the widows, the fatherless, and you had to have stuff to take three times a year to Jerusalem. Those were absolute requirements. If you sinned, you had to bring a sin offering. Trespass, bring a trespass offering. Those were requirements. Everybody okay back there? You couldn't bring what was termed a free will offering until you had done everything else that was required. But a free will offering was a burnt offering so that you would bring the best of what you had by choice to worship God and then destroy the best of what you had. You had to give it up completely for God and do that willingly. And by the way, that is the only place in the Bible where you'll find the word free will. There are a lot of theologies out there developed on the concept of free will. The only place in the Bible where you find the word free will is in the offerings that Israel could give by choice. That's the only place where it shows up. So, here's what you would do with it. Verse 4. When you bring that animal to the tent of meeting, you take it to the doorway to be accepted by the Lord. So the person bringing the animal will lay your hand on the head of the burnt offering that it may be accepted for him to make an atonement on his behalf. So the person bringing the animal, by choice, would put their hand on the animal so that the animal would make an atonement. His blood would be sacrificed on your behalf. It's a substitution. And he will slay the young bull before the Lord, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall offer up the blood and sprinkle the blood around the altar that is at the doorway of the tent of meeting. He shall then skin the burnt offering and cut it into pieces. And the sons of Aaron the priest shall put fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. Then Aaron's sons the priests shall arrange the pieces, the head and the suet over the wood which is on the fire that is on the altar. Its entrails, however, and its legs he shall wash with water, and the priest shall offer up in smoke all of it on the altar for a burnt offering, an offering by fire as a soothing aroma to the Lord. So the whole point of it was to bring an offering to God to send a sweet savor into God's nostrils just so that you could say, God, I know you're there and I appreciate you. It's just a sign of worship. But it required a phenomenal amount of sacrifice and a phenomenal amount of work. Look at what the priests had to do. I can only assume that occasionally they would go, here comes another guy with another bull who willingly wants to make a sacrifice. All right, guys, back to work. Look at the amount of work. You're talking about a bull that they have to slice open. They have to cut the head off. Have to take the entrails. I have to wash the entrails. Have to cut the body into four parts. Have to keep the fire going. Have to put all that up on the altar. Have to burn it completely. And this is one of the easy ones. This one doesn't require that they take parts of it and burn it into ash, change their clothes, go outside the camp, put the ashes into an unclean place, come back, change their clothes so they're clean again, and get back into the temple right away. This is one of the easy ones. How many Israelites? What if they all in one day say, I'm going to bring a burnt offering today? It's a tremendous amount of work.
Was it just the men that did this, or did the women, or did they do it for them?
Just the men.
Okay.
Yep. Verse 11. He shall slay it on the side of the altar northward before the Lord, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall sprinkle its blood around the altar and shall then cut it into its pieces with its head and its suet, and the priest shall arrange them on the wood which is on the fire. The entrails, however, and the legs he shall wash with water, and the priest shall offer all of it and offer it up in the smoke of the altar. It is a burnt offering, an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. Verse 14, but if his offering to the Lord is a burnt offering of birds, Then he shall bring his offering from the turtle doves or from the young pigeons, and the priest shall bring it to the altar and wring off its head and offer it up in the smoke of the altar, and its blood also will be drained out on the side of the altar, and he shall also take away its crop with its feathers and cast it beside the altar eastward to the place of the ashes. Then he shall tear it by its wings, but shall not sever it or cut it in half. And the priests shall offer it up in the smoke of the altar on the wood which is on the fire. It is a burnt offering, an offering by fire of a soothing aroma to the Lord. All I want you to start getting a feel for is the amount of blood, the amount of death, chopping animals open, tearing off wings off birds after you crank their neck off. I can't imagine the amount of death and bloodshed, the smell of the burning and the carcasses and the death. We're going to see a lot of this. We're going to see a lot in the first 7 chapters of this book. We're going to see a lot of this. Just death. And as the writer of Hebrews says, that's because of sin. And there's so much sin, so there's so much death. And God in His grace, God in His glory, provided a sacrifice that satisfied God. 1,400 years of nonstop slaughtered animals was not sufficient to satisfy God's holiness. The one single sacrifice of Christ did what all those animals couldn't. Therefore, all those animals pointed to Christ. Think about cumulatively how much death, how much sacrifice, how much atonement. Cumulatively, how much died over 1,400 years. And that Christ's one death satisfied the debt of all those animals. All the sins that were past, that were covered in those animals, were satisfied in the one death of Christ. And on top of that, you and I found our satisfaction in the single death of Christ. I figure if God can reach back 1,400 years and say, all that death, all those animals, all that sin, all those people covered in Christ, if He can reach that far back, He can reach that far forward. He can even reach to you. And He can say, in Christ, I have done the one thing you could not do. I satisfied myself.
I made you holy,
which was the point to begin with. I'm holy, so you be holy. You couldn't do it. He did it for you. And that's the gospel message.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.